respectfully, it was time to move forward. They were on the last leg of their troubled journey. The great divide yawned on their left, and the path curved slightly and bore them up into gently rolling hills.
"Looks like we got a break," Vol'jin said.
"I don't think any runners made it through to warn them," Vane said.
Vol'jin peered up at him from his raptor.
"They destroyed Camp Dorahomon," he said.
"Yes," said Vane. "They took down a military target, and their general refused to slaughter civilians. He could have given the order to massacre everyone, but he didn't."
Vol'jin's eyes narrowed.
"Will you be showing the same courtesy to these alliance?"
"I do not think there are any civilians in Northwatch Hold," Vane said.
He did not add that he was fairly certain that Garrosh would order him to kill any prisoners he took. Yes, it was a military target, and Garrosh was displaying good tactical leadership in wanting to see it broken. But Garrosh wasn't truly interested in Northwatch as a military target. To him, rendering it useless to the Alliance was not so much a strategy as a stepping stone. His true goal was Theramore. There were plenty of Alliance soldiers and sailors there. But there was also an inn. Merchants and their families dwelt there. And so did one who had never shown anything but friendship to Bane Bloodhoof. They rounded a curve in the road. The view opened up, and Bane could see the gray and white stone of the towers of Northwatch. Just as he lifted a hand to call a halt to prepare for the rush toward the hold, the quiet of the barons erupted with the sound of gunfire. The trolls and Torin responded immediately, aiming their own guns and arrows up at the Alliance soldiers who were attacking from the hills. Bane was furious. He should have expected this, but he had permitted himself to be lulled into a false sense of safety. And now his people fell in their tracks, paying the price for his foolishness.
"Forward!"
he shouted, his voice carrying, fueled by his anger.
"Shaman, interrupt their fire!"
The shaman obeyed, while the rest of the Torin and the trolls surged forward as swiftly as they could. The Alliance riflemen found themselves knocked off their feet, buffeted by sudden winds, or crying out in startled pain as their clothing caught fire. In the chaos that followed, as the riflemen tried to regroup, the Malgor contingent had reached the path to the hold and was engaged in fierce battle.
"The Torin are here!"
The cry was caught up and swept through the ranks of the orcs who were bearing down on the Alliance stronghold from the north. Cheers arose, and Garrosh, swinging Gorehowl as he himself led the charge, spared a moment to give Malkorok a fierce grin. He could hear the sound of massive stones striking the already damaged walls of the hold, and he threw back his head and screamed his delight. He wished that he had done this sooner. The Cataclysm had torn down some walls of the fortress, and the foolish Alliance had not made the effort to properly restore them. Now they would regret it bitterly, and pay for that neglect with blood. The orcs stormed over the makeshift bridges of boulders and planks. A guard charged toward Garrosh, wielding a pike. He was human, strong and deft, and knowledgeable with his weapon, but he could not stand against the Korkron encircling the warchief. Screaming their battle cries, the orcs descended upon him, hacking with swords and slamming maces against his metal-encased body. A blow landed with a crunch that was audible even amid the sounds of the drums, battle, and cannon fire, and the guard crumpled. The Korkron and Garrosh ran over his fallen body, though Garrosh spared the corpse a nod of approval. The rage roar had told them all the weaknesses of the hold. Garrosh knew exactly where to direct his people. The first wave was doing well, surging up the paths to the courtyard areas, and Garrosh scrambled to a higher viewpoint to assess the situation. To his left, the vessels sent by Blood Elves, Goblins, and Forsaken were doing their jobs exactly as planned. Despite what sounded like continuous cannon fire from the Alliance, several dinghies had made it to the shore, their occupants scrambling toward their enemies and cutting them down without mercy. To his right, the Tauren and trolls were ruthlessly hammering at the walls. Even as Garrosh watched, one of them crumbled, and a wave of brown-furred and green and blue-skinned bodies flowed over. And straight ahead, the orcs, his people, the true and original members of the Horde, slaughtered and whooped and laughed. It would take perhaps an hour to finish the job, to penetrate so deeply into the hold that no clever ruse or strategy by Admiral Aubrey could ever win it back. Garrosh did not wish to wait that long. His gaze darted over the scene. The vast bulk of his people had plunged ahead. Only a few remained here, at the outskirts of the battle, picking off the guards who were attempting to keep the fighting outside of the hold. They would not need the makeshift bridges anymore. It was time to deliver the final blow and bring the battle to a swift, decisive victory. A few feet below Garrosh, Malkorok fought three guards, two humans, a male and a female, and one dwarf. Most orcs favored larger weapons, two-handed broadswords, massive axes, or hammers. The Black Rock Orcs' weapons of choice for the battle were instead two small but exquisitely swift and sharp axes. As the three charged him, thinking to enclose him in a circle, Malkorok laughed with glee.
"Death to the Alliance!" he shouted,
crouching and grinning. Then he exploded into motion, moving much faster than the enemy had expected. The axes became a blur, two glittering slices of death. Before she could even realize what was happening, the hapless human female was nearly sliced in two. Malkorok did not slow, whirling around and following the arc of the first axe with the second. The dwarf got in a blow, but his sword clanged uselessly off of Malkorok's armor. Malkorok buried an axe deep into the space between neck and shoulder, and the dwarf crumpled. Snarling, the orc turned, again whirling the axes, his lack of two fingers not hampering him at all. The human male guard brought his sword up to parry, but he could only block one weapon. Uttering a cry, Malkorok lifted the second bloodied blade high and brought it plunging down into the man's chest. He turned, eyes darting about for his next target, but immediately looked up as his name was called by his war chief.
"The Shaman!" shouted Garrosh. "Send the men!"
Malkorok grinned and lifted a fist to show that he had heard. Garrosh nodded once, then grasped Gorhowl. Throwing back his head, he uttered a bellow and dropped down from his vantage point. He leaped onto a boulder in the water and sprang from that to several unevenly placed boards and then to the shoreline. Garrosh Hellscream had uttered the last command he would need to in this battle, and Malkorok saw how happy he was to finally be standing shoulder to shoulder with his brethren and using his father's famous weapon to slaughter a lion's. Malkorok reached out, grabbed the nearest Corcron, and repeated the order. The other orc nodded and raced back toward the north, where most of the shaman were waiting. They'd been held in reserve for this moment. Within minutes, several shaman were hurrying toward the battlefront. Most of them were orcs. They wore not the simple white or earth-brown robes common to their ranks, but more ominous-looking garments that made them more akin to warlocks, and they moved with barely contained excitement. Heavily armored warriors escorted them, forcing their way through clusters of frantically battling Horde and Alliance. The shaman made no effort to join the fight. They were focused on the boulders, covered with water and mud, several yards ahead. As they approached, the shaman slowed, calming their breathing. They eyed one another, sharing secret smiles, then lifted their hands and uttered the commands that would cause the elements to obey. Malkorok knew what was to come, but he paused a moment in the battle to watch, his heart swelling with orcish pride. There were at least two dozen boulders in the water. They had enabled the troops and the heavier weapons to cross, and now their second purpose was about to be fulfilled. Before Malkarok's eager gaze, the boulders quivered. Their hue turned from the dark red and brown of simple stone to a redder shade, then a mottled orange one, and they began to melt. But the water did not cool them or stop this change, turning the magma back into rock as nature usually would. Instead, the water boiled and steamed away, as if the element of water itself was recoiling in fear from what was now in its depths. The stones continued to shudder and pulse as they lost shape and became liquid, their heat so powerful that even the shaman who controlled them were forced to turn their heads away or take a step back. A tendril shot out from one of the rocks. A second tendril followed, then another, and another. The other boulders followed suit, the tendrils shortening, becoming denser, sprouting fingers and toes. A head burst through the top part of the rock, and a mouth gaped open. Small, glowing eyes looked about, down at the rock body, at the shaman who controlled that body. One of the creatures growled, turning slowly around, reaching out for a black leather-clad orc, who raised a commanding hand. The molten giant, for such it was, cringed back, muttering, then began to move forward. It would obey. Even the orcs, who knew to expect this, seemed awestruck by the sight.
As well they should be, thought Malkarok. Alliance! He cried. Behold the power that Garrosh Hellscream controls! Behold and tremble and die!
Bane swung his mace, fighting off two soldiers with pikes. All around him, the air was full of sound, the crackle of gunfire, the booming of the cannons, the singing of arrows being loosed, and over and around it all, the cries of Horde and Alliance fighting, killing, and dying. One of the soldiers lunged toward him. Bane moved more swiftly than the man had bargained for, and the pike stabbed only empty air. Bane's mace slammed into him as he stumbled, and the human fell. The other Northwatch soldier thought he had an opening, but Bane's mace snapped the pike's shaft as if it were a twig, and, on the backswing, crunched the soldier's skull as if it were an acorn. Bane shook his head, regret filling him. At least he offered a swift death. It was then that the sounds changed. A new one was added, a deep bellow of anger, as if the earth itself had been given voice. Bane's ears pricked up at once, and his head turned to follow the sound. His eyes widened. Before he could speak, though, another voice rose, loud and full of righteous anger.
"In the name of the Earth Mother," cried Kador Cloudsong. "Garrosh, what have you done?"
"What are these things?" Bane demanded.
Kador turned to him, his fur bristling with outrage.
"They are molten giants," he said. "Powerful fire elementals that do not work willingly with the shaman, but must be forced to obey. The Earth Mother is angry that her children are so used. The Earthen Ring has forbidden such things. They fear it could cause further instability in the Earth."
"Like the Cataclysm," Bane murmured.
The aptly named molten giants were seemingly reveling in destruction. They strode about, towering over both Horde and Alliance, swinging their arms and smashing whatever had the misfortune to be in their way. Bane had seen enough.
"Retreat!" he cried. "Retreat! Fall back, Torin of Mulgore!"
He had honored his word and brought his braves into battle. They had fought with courage. He had fulfilled his obligation to Garrosh and would not stand by and watch a single one of his people fall to these monsters in the name of the war chief's foolish and dangerous arrogance.
"Behold and die!"
The Horde took up the cry, their bloodlust renewed by something approaching giddy gleefulness. The Alliance defenders, as Garrosh predicted, were defeated in that moment. They were terrified by nearly a dozen molten rock monsters that were bearing down on them. Many fell beneath a simple footfall. Others died as, with an almost casual blow, the remaining walls were reduced to rubble.
"Stand firm, Alliance soldiers!"
The cry came from one of the towers. Laughing softly, Malkroc glanced up to see the human, wearing an admiral's hat, desperately and futilely attempting to rally his troops. It was foolish, but Malkroc could not help but respect the doomed human. He, at least, would die with honor. But most of those he commanded were fleeing, and Malkroc could not blame them. It was, after all, what Garrosh had counted on. Terrified beyond thought, the majority had simply flung down their weapons and raced for the safety of the water or the hills. Anywhere but here, facing death from creatures made of liquid rock and hatred. The fleeing soldiers made easy prey for the horde fighters who were waiting at all the exits. Almost too easy. If any survived, Malkroc mused, they would have to count themselves among the luckiest of beings. Malkroc continued to charge at the Alliance soldiers seeking escape. They were too frightened to even fight well, and he cut them down swiftly. After a few moments, he realized there was no more activity in the immediate area. What Alliance members he could see lay very still. He looked around, eyes narrowed, for any pockets of fighting. There was none. Even so, the molten giants continued to march, bellowing and slamming at the remains of the walls, smashing the mighty cannons and other engines of war, like so much kindling. Malkroc spied Garrosh, standing over the body of a worgen. Its head lay a yard away, its lupine features locked in a snarl, but its eyes wide with fear. Garrosh turned to the Blackrock orc, his face and body spattered with blood, and smiled fiercely around his tusks.
"Well," he demanded. "We have won, my war chief," said Malkroc. "I see no alliance other than corpses."
Garrosh's grin widened, and he threw back his head, spread his arms, and let forth a mighty howl of triumph.
"Victory to the Horde! Victory to the Horde!"
The cry was picked up and repeated, sweeping like wildfire through the troops. Malkroc noticed that the molten giants slowed, then stopped, and he realized that the dark shaman who had summoned them had also heard the happy shouts of victory and were now sending the earth elementals back to whence they had come. Or attempting to. The molten giants, it seemed, had no wish to lose this form. They turned slowly, small heads with glowing red eyes moving as they sought their masters. Grunting, they began to surge forward. Malkroc and Garrosh looked about for the dark-clad forms, who were gesticulating with a vigor that bordered on frantic. For a moment, elementals and shaman were locked in a struggle of wills. Then, as one, the molten giants opened their mouths to let out a chilling cry of both rage and defeat. The earth itself replied. Malkroc felt the ground beneath him tremble, slightly at first, then with more intensity. Alarmed, he glanced about, but there was no shelter, not here. There were only corpses and weapons and rubble where a hold had once stood. Shouts of warning filled the air, as many lost their footing, falling hard on the earth and clinging to it, even though it was now the enemy. Suddenly, dark clouds gathered. Lightning flashed, and a nearly deafening crack of thunder followed immediately. The mouths of the molten giants kept opening, wider, wider still, as their heads and shoulders started to melt and dissolve. The elemental beings lost cohesion, their limbs flowing back into a single mass. The color faded, cooled, becoming first dark red, then brown, as the elementals shrank back to their original forms, now merely boulders, nothing more. A final buck and shudder from the earth, and then it was still. The silence pressed like cotton on Malkorok's ears, hot from the noise that had assaulted them. The horde members who had fallen to the earth got to their feet, cautiously, and then cheers filled the air once again.
"We have not only defeated the Alliance," said Garrosh, stepping beside Malkorok and clapping him on the back. "We have shown our mastery over the very elements."
"What you have shown," said a deep, rumbling voice
that was rich and cold with fury,
"is that you are reckless, Garrosh Hellscream."
Both orcs whirled to see Bane Bloodhoof and one of his shaman. Bane was in full war regalia, his face decorated, but not with war paint. His armor, too, was spattered with blood. But he was not reveling in victory. Bane continued.
"Cador Cloudsong tells me that the Earthen Ring has specifically forbidden the sort of thing you have meddled with, Hellscream."
Malkorok frowned.
"You will address him as War Chief," the Blackrock Orc said in a low voice. "Very well. War Chief," said Bane. "Your choice to use these molten giants is an offense to the Earth Mother and to the Horde you claim to lead. Do you not understand what you are doing? Did you not feel the angry wrath of the Earth itself? You could bring about a second cataclysm. By the ancestors, did you learn nothing from the first one?"
"I have made the cataclysm work in our favor," shouted Garrosh.
"This,"
and he stabbed a finger at the rubble that had once been Northwatch Hold,
"is the first major step toward complete and utter conquest of this continent. Theramore falls next, and I will use whatever tool I need to in order to achieve these goals, Torin." "You will not endanger..."
Malkorok grabbed Bane's arm and shoved his face up toward the Torrens.
"Silence! You serve at the War Chief's whim, Bane Bloodhoof. Do you offer him insult? Do you? Because if you do, I challenge you to a Makgora."
He was seething and prayed that the Torren would accept the challenge. This Bloodhoof, like his father before him, had long been a thorn in the side of the orcs. The Torren as a whole were too soft, too pacifistic, and the Bloodhoof were the worst. Malkorok considered Cairn's death to be a good thing, regardless of how it had happened. He would deem it an honor to put Bane Bloodhoof out of Garrosh's misery. Bane's eyes flickered with fury. Then he growled low.
"I have lost many braves today, obeying the War Chief's word. I have no desire to lose any more Horde lives needlessly."
He turned to Garrosh.
"I speak only from concern for what may come. You know that, War Chief."
Garrosh nodded.
"Your concern is noted, but unwarranted. I know what I'm doing. I know what my shaman can handle. These are my methods, High Chieftain. My next step will be to march on Theramore. There, I will cut off the Alliance supply line to Kalimdor and destroy the Proudmoor bitch who confuses diplomacy with meddling. I have plans for Feathermoon Stronghold, Teldrassil, the Moonglade, Lordanel, too. All will fall. And then you will see. You'll see how things stand."
He laughed.
"And when you do, I will accept your apology graciously. Until then,"
Garrosh sobered,
"I will hear no more word from you about any concerns. Do we understand each other?"
Bane's ears flattened and his nostrils flared.
"Yes, my War Chief, you have made yourself quite clear."
Malkorok watched him go. Bane felt as if his own core were molten with outrage. It was with the greatest of efforts that he had kept from exploding in anger when Malkorok had challenged him. He was not afraid Malkorok could defeat him. By all accounts, Cairn had been winning the battle against Garrosh before Magatha's poison had claimed him. Bane bore his father's blood, and he had youth on his side. No, he had declined because there was no way to truly win. Poison would be used again, but better hidden this time. Or even if he slew Malkorok, there would be an ambush waiting in the shadows. And then, what would happen to his people? There was no clear successor yet. Garrosh would somehow see to it that a Tauren was appointed whose thinking was more in line with his own, or who could be persuaded to think so. No, his people needed him alive. And so Bane would live and do what he was ordered to do. Exactly, and only what he was ordered to do. And when all this exploded in Garrosh's tattooed face, as it certainly would, Bane, Vol'jin, and other cooler heads would be there to pick up the pieces and protect the Horde. What Garrosh had left of it, at least. But Bane Bloodhoof was not helpless. The idea that had been forming as he began the march on Northwatch had solidified. Seeing Garrosh's thoughtless, heedless, selfish manipulation of the elements for personal power had merely confirmed in Bane's head what he knew in his heart to be the right path. He had left orders to the Tauren he commanded to attend to the bodies of the fallen. They would receive the proper death rituals. Too, he had ordered his people not to desecrate the bodies of the Alliance. Such disregard displeased the Earth Mother, who loved all her children. He did not stay for the ceremonies, leaving them in the capable hands of Kador. He retired to his traveling teepee to put his plan into motion. Before lifting the flap, he looked about carefully. There were no signs of any listening ears. To a young brave standing guard outside, he said,
"Send me Perith Stormhoof. I have a very important task for him."
Chapter 9
"We ought to be able to figure this out," said Jaina,
anger, a feeling she rarely experienced, creeping into her voice.
"We've got a blue dragon, two extremely skilled magi, and a talented and insightful apprentice, plus the Kirin Tor at our disposal."
She ran a hand through her blonde hair, forcing back the emotion that threatened to cloud her thoughts. She couldn't afford the luxury of anger or irritation now. She had to think.
"Lady, there simply is no record anywhere of a spell that can hide a magical object from being sensed by a superior mage," Kindi said. "We've got to assume that Kalikthos here is superior to any mage of the shorter-lived Azerothian races. And, begging your pardon, but it's hard to sit here and think and ponder and twiddle our thumbs while Northwatch may be falling to the Horde right this moment."
"Not to make light of your concern, Kindi," said Kalikthos, "but if I do not recover the focusing iris, the destruction that could be wrought on this world will make the fall of Northwatch look like a captured piece in a board game."
Kindi frowned and looked away.
"We all are distracted," Jaina said, forcing calm upon her mind. "But Kallik's right. The sooner we can figure out how its abductors are hiding the focusing iris from Kallik's sensing, the safer we will all be."
Kindi nodded.
I know, she said. "But it's hard."
Jaina regarded her apprentice and thought of the last time she'd seen her own master, Antonidas. They had stood together in his happily disorganized study, and she had asked, begged, to stay and help him defend Dalaran against Arthas Menethil. Arthas had already arrived, was standing right outside, shouting taunts that wounded Jaina as much as if they had been physical arrows. How desperately she'd wanted to protect the beautiful mage city. And how bitter it had been to know that Arthas, her Arthas, was the one responsible for the threat to it. But Antonidas had refused to permit her to linger.
"You have other duties," he had said. "Keep safe those you have promised to take care of, Jaina Proudmoore. One more or one less here will make no difference."
Jaina had no doubt that she and Kallik could make a difference at Northwatch,
if they arrived in time. But even if they did, what then? Every minute counted now. They still didn't know who had the cursed artifact, or what his or her plans were. And so, just as leaving Antonidas to die and Dalaran to fall had been the right thing to do, wrenching though the choice had been, she had to believe that staying here and finding the Iris were the right things to do this time. Jaina felt the tears in her eyes again, even after so long. She reached over and squeezed Kindi's limp hand. Part of becoming a mage and having so much responsibility is learning how to make the hard choices. I understand how you feel, Kindi, but we are where we need to be. Kindi nodded. The gnome girl was tired, as were they all. Her pink hair was messily tied, and there were circles under her large eyes. Tervash looked years older than his actual age. Even Kallik's lips were pressed together in a thin line, and Jaina didn't want to know what she looked like. She'd been avoiding mirrors. Her brow furrowed as she examined yet another scroll. Then, abruptly, she put it down and looked at them all. Kindi is right about the fact that there is no known record of a spell that can do what is being done. But obviously someone figured it out because it's happening right now. Someone is hiding the artifact from Kallikos. And I simply refuse to believe that we can't undo this. She slammed her hand down on the table, and they all looked at her, startled. Jaina never erupted in fits of temper. If we know what spell was used, or even can make a guess at the type, we can determine how to counter it.
But,
Kindi said, then bit her lip as Jaina shot her a sharp look. No buts. No excuses. No one knew how to respond. Kallikos was regarding her curiously, a faint frown of worry on his lips. Once again, Jaina reached for calm. I'm sorry I raised my voice. But surely, surely we will find a way to solve this. Kindi rose and got them all fresh tea as they sat in silence. Finally, Kallikos spoke in a halting, uncertain voice.
Let's agree that there is no known spell that can hide so powerful an object from a mage as skilled as I am, especially as I have a unique connection to the focusing iris, he said.
Jaina took a sip of the tea, letting the familiar scent and taste steady her, and nodded that he should continue.
So the logical conclusion is either that there is a mage out there, clever enough to create such a spell, or that's not what's going on here.
What do you mean, that's not what's going on here?
Yelped Kindi.
That's exactly what's going on.
Jaina lifted a hand. It trembled slightly, with renewed hope.
Hold on a moment, she said. Kallik, I think I know what you were getting at.
He smiled, radiant and happy.
I knew you would.
It's not actually being hidden, Jaina said, encouraged by his reaction.
She worked it through step by step as she spoke, getting to her feet and pacing.
We just think it is because we can't sense it.
And we can't sense it because it's not what we're looking for, Kallik said.
Exactly!
Someone care to enlighten us, poor mortals, said Tervash dryly.
He was leaning his chair back, the front two legs off the floor.
I'm not following this at all.
Jaina turned to him.
What were you last Hallow's End? She said.
She fought back a pang as she recalled one Hallow's End in particular. Arthas had invited her to Lordaeron for the traditional lighting of the Wicker Man. The effigy was supposed to metaphorically burn away things those watching the event wished to be free of. Jaina had lit the Wicker Man on fire with a spell, to the delight of the onlookers. Later that night, Jaina felt that she and Arthas had cast a spell of their own. By the light of the flames of the Wicker Man, Jaina herself had taken Arthas's hand and led him to the bed where they would first become lovers.
I beg your pardon?
Tervash looked at her as if she had gone quite mad. Jaina firmly steered her thoughts back to the present, and the problem they might just be on the verge of solving.
What did you become in order to attend the celebrations? She asked the other mage.
And Tervish's eyes widened as comprehension dawned. He leaned forward, and the chair came to the floor with a thump.
The silly little spell from that commonplace wand made me become a pirate, he said. I am trying to magically sense one thing, and it is manifesting as something else. That silly little spell you speak of provides just enough misdirection so that I can't trace the focusing iris, said Calicos.
His gaze grew distant, and then he grinned.
Or at least, I couldn't.
And you can now,
Kindy crowed excitedly. He nodded.
Yes and no. It comes and goes.
Because whoever put the silly little spell on the thing knows that he or she needs to change it from time to time, because it wears off, said Jaina.
Exactly.
Kallak, who had also risen during the conversation, now closed the distance between himself and Jaina in three long-legged strides. Jaina thought he was going to embrace her, but he merely clasped her hands, squeezing them tightly. His hands were warm and strong and comforting.
Jaina, you're brilliant, he said.
She felt color rise to her face. I just followed through on your idea, she said.
I had a general idea, he said. You figured out precisely what happened and how to see through the illusion. I have to go now that I know where it is.
He hesitated.
I realize you're concerned about Northwatch, but please stay here. I can track the focusing iris, but I don't have it back yet. I may still need your help.
Jaina thought painfully of what might be transpiring, or what might have already transpired at Northwatch Hold. She bit her lip for a moment, then nodded. I will stay, she said.
Thank you. I know how difficult this must be.
Good luck, Calicos, said Tervash.
I hope you find it quickly, said Kindy.
Thank you. I certainly have a better chance now. You have all been of such great help. I hope that I will have good news for you shortly.
As he started to stride out, Jaina followed him. They said nothing as they descended the winding stairway to the ground level, and neither felt the silence uncomfortable. Kallak stepped out into the sunlight and turned once again to Jaina.
You will find it, Jaina said firmly.
Kallak smiled gently.
When you say it so confidently, I believe I will, he replied.
Be safe, she said,
then felt foolish. He was a dragon, and not just any dragon, a former aspect. What on this continent could truly threaten him? And then she thought of the dragons that had been killed when the focusing iris had been abducted, and suddenly her concern didn't feel quite so foolish, after all.
I will, he said seriously.
Then a grin got the better of him.
I'll be back for more of those delicious biscuits you serve with your tea.
Jaina laughed. He lingered a moment longer. Why, she wasn't certain, then bowed and moved a distance away from her. He changed so swiftly, she gasped. Where before a handsome half-elven male had stood, suddenly there was an enormous blue dragon, no less handsome in his own way, but also powerful and not a little frightening. To call him blue was to insult the vast palette of that color with which he'd been painted. Azure, cobalt, cerulean, even the unique light blue shade of ice. Calicos the dragon bore them all. He flexed mighty wings, doubtless enjoying the sensation after staying so long in his half-elven form. Beautiful, deadly, dangerous, glorious. He was all these things. And Jaina suddenly paled when she recalled how sharply she'd spoken to him on occasion. He could not read her thoughts, but perhaps he didn't have to. Calicos switched a tail adorned with barbs that looked like icicles, turned his massive horned head on his long, sinuous neck, and caught Jaina's gaze. She couldn't look away. He gave her a quick wink. He was Calicos, the mighty dragon, the former aspect, yes. And he was Kallak, the humorous, insightful friend who had taught her the true beauty and magnificence inherent in the arcane.
the almost alarmed awe in which Jaina had held him a moment ago, dissolved like a snowflake in the sunlight, and the mage felt her whole body shed tension, as if she were dropping a too-heavy cloak. She gave him a smile and a wave. He dipped his head in acknowledgement, then looked skyward. His massive feet moved beneath him as, like a giant cat, he gathered himself for the leap. Then Kalikkos was airborne, the great wings creating a gentle wind as they beat. Upward he flew, swiftly and with purpose. Jaina shielded her eyes against the sun as he climbed higher, becoming a small dot against the sky, and then finally disappeared. She stood there a moment longer, then turned and entered the keep, wondering why she felt oddly bereft. Hallow's End costumes, indeed. Kalikko snorted as he flew, trying and failing to keep from scolding himself for missing something so simple. But the similarity that had alerted Jaina to the spell's nature came from a celebration that was not of his culture. Hallow's End was not a dragon festival, nor were the great creatures accustomed to donning costumes. Well, other than their bipedal forms, of course. But those were simply another manifestation of themselves. It was not intended as an illusion or trick. Or was it? After all, some dragons did use this transformation of their appearance to mingle with the younger races unnoticed. Therefore, one could, albeit uncharitably, call it a trick. But Kalikkos had never felt that he was in disguise as Kalik. He was himself. He just looked different. It was all very confusing, this penchant of the younger races to use magic in so light-hearted a fashion. It had taken Jaina, who was familiar with such basic little magics, to put two and two together. It was yet another example of why, in this new world that had averted the hour of twilight, the dragons needed to listen to what they formerly dismissed as frivolousness. Now that he knew what was going on, as he told Jaina, he could sense the focusing iris by magically looking for what it really was, not what its captors wanted it to be. Focusing on the true arcane essence of the artifact, and not the costume it wore. Even so, Kalikkos still did not sense it as strongly as he had before it had vanished. But it was there, like a faint whiff of a scent in the mind. There were moments, long ones, when it seemed to disappear again. At such times, Kalikkos called on the patience of his race, and simply hovered, trusting that the focusing iris would reappear to his now awakened understanding of what to seek. One issue both puzzled and worried him, and that was the speed at which the cursed thing was traveling. It seemed to be flying at speeds he knew none of the younger races should be able to achieve. How was that possible? Who had the ability to do this? If he could figure that out, he would solve the mystery. A thought, seductive and heartbreaking at the same time, crept into his mind. Would he have been able to find the focusing iris more quickly if he still had an aspect's abilities? He shook his head angrily. That was a dangerous path down which to travel, one that could only end in despair. There was no room for the enormous yet tiny word, if. That was the siren song of utter failure, disguised in its own costume of wishful thinking. What was, and he needed all the wisdom and clear-headedness and confidence he could muster if disaster was to be averted. Jaina found, somewhat to her surprise, that she missed Kalik's presence. He was never inappropriately dismissive of the direness of their situation. Indeed, he, more than anyone, bore the burden of locating the focusing iris, since it belonged to his flight. But he brought a certain lightness to an otherwise dark and frightening quest. His wit and mind were quick, his manner gentle and kind, his insight great. He seemed to know exactly when to suggest a break, or when to push for the breakthrough, the new place to look, or the new way of thinking, that made all four of them want to continue, despite the odds. And, she had to admit, in his half-elven form, he was not at all unpleasant to look at. She realized, with mild surprise, that it had been a long time since she had allowed herself to enjoy simple things like male company and quiet conversation. Even longer since she had felt, well, safe enough to open up to work so fully and completely with another. Jaina had learned through bitter experience that part of being a good diplomat was never truly letting your guard down, nor showing all your cards. To do so was to expose yourself, to become vulnerable. And while a diplomat could certainly make gestures of trust and honestly work for what was best for everyone, he or she should never become vulnerable. To become so was to lose all. Jaina had once thought she had lost all when Arthas fell to darkness. She had learned that she had not, but nonetheless she had remained guarded, as a diplomat and as a person. She realized she'd become vulnerable with Kalikos. He seemed to coax it from her without her even being aware of it. How odd, she thought, the drollness of the situation curving her lips in a smile. I feel safe with a dragon. Then again, she had felt safe with Goel, too. An orc, for light's sake, the war chief of the Horde. But she had never allowed herself to be truly vulnerable. Though they all hoped that Kallik would be able to locate the focusing iris, now that he could once again properly identify it, there was still work to be done, in case the trail went cold. Tervash was investigating distance confinement spells, and Kindi had returned to Dalaran to rummage through a trunk of scrolls that had been tucked in the far back of the library.
"You'd envy me," she had told Jaina when they spoke through the mirror. "There's dust everywhere."
On a less hopeful and more brutally practical note, Jaina, Tervash, and Paind had begun to examine ways, both magical and mundane, to evacuate the major Alliance cities if the abductors chose to strike using the focusing iris. Jaina had wondered aloud about notifying the Horde, but Paind gave her a sharp look.
"My lady," she said, "we cannot discount the possibility that it is members of the Horde who stole the thing in the first place."
"Nor can we discount that it might be members of the Alliance," Jaina said. "Magic is known to both, Paind. Kel'Thuzad used to be a member of the Kirin Tor. Or it could be some other race entirely. Kalimdor is a large continent."
"Then let us create some possibilities for the Horde, too," suggested Tervash,
long used to finding common ground between the two women.
"It couldn't hurt."
"And if the Horde is attacked, then perhaps offering aid swiftly can help build trust," Jaina the diplomat said. Paind grimaced, but said nothing. After so long feeling as if she were wrestling with air, with no idea what to search for or where to turn, plotting something concrete like evacuation strategies for the major cities of Kalimdor was a relief. Jaina dropped easily, almost mechanically, into her logical, rational mind. Kallik had taught her what she already knew, but did not realize she knew, that magic was mathematics. There was always some way for things to fit together correctly, and if there was not, well, you just hadn't found that way yet. The afternoon wound down into evening. After so many late nights and early mornings, Jaina welcomed rest. She crawled into bed almost as soon as the sun had set. Certain that Kallik would locate the iris now, and that their troubles, at least from that quarter, would shortly be resolved, she fell asleep quickly.
"My lady!"
Jaina was so groggy that the urgent voice seemed part of her dream. She blinked awake to see a tall form with long ears silhouetted against the window. "Paind?" she murmured.
"A messenger has come. We have intercepted,"
and Paind's voice conveyed her doubt,
"a Horde member who insists he speak with you."
Now Jaina was fully awake. She slipped out of bed and grabbed a wrap, lighting the lamps with a quick gesture. Paind was dressed in her usual armor.
"He claims to have been sent from Northwatch Hold, where the Alliance has fallen to the Horde."
Jaina's breath caught. Perhaps she should have gone to Northwatch after Kalikos left. She sighed bitterly.
I'm relieved that whoever found him didn't kill him on sight.
He openly approached the guards, Payne said, and he brought this as a token. He assured them you would recognize it and wish to speak with him. The guards thought they should at least confirm his story.
Payne held out a white, covered bundle. Jaina accepted it, noting that it was quite heavy. She gently removed the linen, and her eyes widened. It was a mace, a thing of great beauty, and clearly of dwarven craftsmanship. The head was silver, wrapped in intersecting bands of gold. Small gems were inlaid here and there, and it had runes etched upon it as well. Jaina gazed at it raptly for a moment, then looked up at Payne.
"Bring him to me," was all she said.
A few moments later, the horde messenger, Jaina no longer thought of him as a spy, was escorted in. He was a huge shape, his form concealed by an encompassing cloak, and towered over the guards. Jaina got the feeling that, had he wished to, he could easily have dispatched both of them in a moment. Instead, he permitted himself to be roughly led in.
"Leave us," Jaina said.
"My lady?" one of them asked. "Leave you alone with this creature?"
She glanced at the guard sharply.
"He has come to me in good faith, and you will not speak so of him."
The guard colored slightly. The two bowed to their mistress, then withdrew, closing the parlor doors behind them. The huge shape straightened. One hand emerged from the depths of the cloak to shrug off the hood, and Jaina found herself gazing into the calm, proud visage of a Tauren.
"Lady Jaina Proudmore," he said, inclining his head. "My name is Perith Stormhoof. I come on orders from my High Chieftain. He asked me to give you the mace. He said, it would help you to believe my words are truth."
Jaina clutched the mace. "I would never mistake Fearbreaker," she said. She recalled the time when she, Bane Bloodhoof, and Anduin Rin had sat together in this very chamber. Moved by Bane's loss and uncertainty at assuming the title of his slain father, the human prince had rushed to his room and returned with this mace. It had been given to Anduin by King Magni Bronzebeard, and Jaina was touched to see the boy offering it to Bane, the child of an Alliance king gifting the child of a Horde High Chieftain with something precious and beautiful. When Bane had accepted the gift, Fearbreaker had shown its approval by glowing softly in the Tauren's giant hand.
"He knew you would not. Lady Jaina, my High Chieftain thinks gratefully and highly of you, and it is because of the memory of the night when he received Fearbreaker that he has sent me with this warning. Northwatch Hold has fallen to the Horde."
He did not speak with pleasure. Indeed, Perith seemed grim and sad.
"It further wounds him that this victory was won with the usage of dark shamanic magic. He despises these actions, but to protect his people, Bane has agreed that the Tauren will continue to serve the Horde as they are needed. He wishes me to emphasize that at times, this obligation brings him little joy."
Jaina nodded. "Well, do I believe that? Still, he has participated in an act of violence against the Alliance. Northwatch Hold
is only a start," Perith said, interrupting her. "Hellscream would reach much farther than a simple hold."
"What?"
"His goal is nothing less than the conquest of the continent," said Perith.
The words relentless and horrifying, even when spoken by this calm Tauren.
"He will shortly be ordering the Horde to march on Theramor. And mark me well, their numbers are strong. As you are now, you will fall."
The statement was not delivered to intimidate. It was blunt and to the point. Simple reality. Jaina swallowed.
"My High Chieftain remembers the aid you gave him and asked me to warn you. He has no wish to see you caught unawares."
Jaina was overwhelmed at the gesture. "Your High Chieftain," she said, her heart full. "Is it truly honorable, Tauren? I am proud to be so highly regarded by him. I thank him for this timely warning. Please tell him it will help save innocent lives."
"He regrets that a warning is all he can give you, my lady. And he asks you to please take Fearbreaker
and return it to the one who so kindly gifted it to him. Bane feels that it is no longer his to keep.
Jaina nodded, though quick tears stung her eyes. She had hoped that that night would be the beginning of healing, of understanding, but it was not to be. Bane was telling her, in his typically gentle but firm fashion, that their friendship only went so far. He was not, and would never become, a member of the Alliance. He would stand and fight with the Horde. She understood. She was fully aware of how vulnerable the Torren people would be if they stood against Garrosh now, and she had no wish to see them come to harm.
"I will see to it that Fearbreaker is returned to its former owner," she said, with a few simple words conveying all the shades and complexities of what was in her heart. Perith was a fine courier. He understood and bowed deeply.
Jaina went to the small desk that was on the far end of the room. Locating parchment, ink, quill, and wax, she quickly wrote a brief note. She dusted powder on the ink to dry it, folded the missive, then sealed it with red wax and her own personal stamp. Rising, she handed it to the waiting Torren.
"This will ensure your safe passage through Alliance territory, if you're caught."
He chuckled.
"I will not be, but your concern is appreciated."
"And tell your noble High Chieftain there will be no rumors of a Torren Longwalker visiting me. To all who would ask, I will say that word reached me from an Alliance scout who managed to escape the battle. Take refreshment, then return safely."
"May the Earth Mother smile upon you, lady," said Perith. "I understand my High Chieftain's choice even better now that I've met you."
She gave him a sad smile. "One day, perhaps, we will fight on the same side."
"One day, perhaps, but that day is not today."
Jaina acknowledged this truth with a nod. "Light be with you, Perith Stormhoof."
"And the Earth Mother's blessing be upon you."
She watched him go, fighting an irrational urge to call him back, to offer him, Bane, all the Torren people, asylum. She did not want to have to face Bane in battle, to utter spells that would kill these gentle, wise beings. But the Torren were hunters, warriors, and would never shirk their duty. Bane had already done all he could, more, in fact, than Jaina had ever expected. Some would call this warning treason. She hoped that Bane's gesture would not result in tragedy for the Torren High Chieftain. Jaina buried her face in her hands, gathering strength. Then, composing herself, she called for Pained.
"Rouse Tervash and recall Kindi. Have them meet me in the library.
May I ask what is going on?"
Jaina turned a tired visage to her bodyguard and friend.
"War," was all she said.
Chapter 10. The focusing iris appeared to have sprouted wings, so swiftly was it traveling. Like a mastiff on the scent, Kalikkos had spent most of the day dutifully following where it led. It had been to the northwest of Theramore when he had departed that isle, and Kalikkos suspected it was now in Malgor, perhaps near Thunder Bluff. When Kalikkos had made it to the Great Gate, the iris stopped for a moment, then began moving northeast toward Orgrimmar. Kallik followed, flying as quickly as his wings would allow in an attempt to catch up. No sooner had he gotten to the crossroads than the focusing iris shifted course yet again, this time heading almost directly south. A realization struck him, as shocking as lightning, and his wing beats faltered.
"You are clever, my enemy," he said softly.
They were no fools, but he had been one more than once on this journey. First, he had failed to see through a simple spell, and then he had arrogantly assumed that the thieves who had absconded with the focusing iris hadn't counted on being followed. Of course they had. One didn't steal a priceless magical artifact from a dragonflight without being prepared for repercussions. They had known someone from the Blue Dragonflight, probably Calicos himself, would come in search of the focusing iris. They had not only disguised the object, but were now ferrying it about somehow, from place to place, in an effort to exhaust him as he followed something he would never get close enough to find. He believed the human